You are listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. I would like to get started so we have time to hear from our speakers and plenty of time for discussion. We're very fortunate this afternoon to have the release of a publication that has been in the works for some time and really reflects some of the best thinking of Carnegie and others concerned with democracy about how to look at the political system in Russia as it's been evolving over the last several years. So we are going to hear from the authors of the paper, and if you didn't have it, it's available outside, but I think it was largely available here at the table. The topic is over managed democracy in Russia, governance implications of hybrid regimes. That all sounds rather abstract, but I can assure you our speakers are going to be quite concrete about some of the more recent developments in Russia in the last year to year or so. I don't think the authors really need much of an introduction, but I will simply note that Henry Hale is Associate Professor of Political Science and International Affairs at George Washington University, and he directs the Institute for European, Russian, and Eurasian Studies. He's been working with Nikolai Petrov and Masha for some time on this project, and I think will be our first speaker. Nikolai Petrov is, I think, well known to this community. He is at our center in Moscow and is an acknowledged authority on Russia's regions and the role of center regional relations in the political system of the Russian Federation. And Maria Lipman, or as I call her, Masha Lipman, is a longstanding journalist by training, but has been at Carnegie editing our journal Pro et Contra for a number of years. And she is really one of the best minds watching what is going on in Russian media and its place in the development of Russian political culture and the society. So what I'd like to do is I'm going to ask Henry Hale to begin, Nikolai Petrov to go second, and Masha to be third speaker. And then, as is the custom, we will talk about the topic with questions and answers and comments from the audience. When you do ask a question or want to make a statement, if you'll identify yourself and use the microphone, we're recording this for a website and so forth. So I think without further ado, I will turn the floor to Henry Hale, and he will begin with a sort of overview of this project. Henry?
Okay, thank you very much. So I will talk fairly briefly before turning it over to my colleagues. Just to start off the discussion, I think it's worth observing that we are currently very close to the midway point in Medvedev's first term. It's been over 2 years since he was elected. And if we think about how his first term so far might compare with the first half of the terms of other Russian presidents, we think back to Yeltsin and recall that during his first 2 years, among many other things, he had signed the CIS Treaty, effectively dissolving the USSR, introduced radical economic reforms, conducted a referendum on constitutional structure and confidence in the president and the parliament, which ultimately set the stage for the October 1993 showdown. If we look at Putin, certainly within the first 2 years since he was elected, he had created the federal districts, reformed the Federation Council, the upper house of parliament, removing the governors from that body, essentially, instituted a new relationship between the state and the oligarchs, which later came to, I think, real fruition with the arrest of Mikhail Khodorkovsky slightly after the midway point in his first term, introduced a 13% flat tax in the economy, which constituted a fairly radical change. So these presidents had all done quite a bit during their first 2 years in office. So I think the 2 years is a good amount of time. It's time enough for people to, in this office, to use it to do something. And it's useful, therefore, to assess whether a leader is instituting real changes. And at least judging by the previous two presidents, the first 2 years would give us a good indication as to where these systems are going. So now, Nikolai, Masha, and I each have our own writings on the general subject of the tandem and what the Russian system works. But currently what we're involved in is a process of developing a book where we're hammering out a common view on several of the more important questions regarding Russian politics today, most basic ones including what the system is, how it works, how it actually supplies governance. And I think that's one of the interesting things that interests us most about it, because we see a lot of studies of political control, who exercises power. But how is the state doing in terms of how it actually gets things done? You know, what are the implications for the management and control system for how services are actually provided? You know, how does the state do things that the state is supposed to do? Or at least that people might expect it to do. And finally, how the Russian system compares with political systems in other countries. And so, as Jim kindly mentioned, the first product is this of our joint work is this working paper on overmanaged democracy in Russia, where it spells out some of the general propositions and then goes into detail in certain areas of that study. We already made a presentation at an earlier stage of this project when it was still a work very much in progress, and so I won't reiterate everything there. But what I will try to do is just generally outline the broad perspective with which we're working, and noting that, in fact, this is still a work in progress, and we're all you know, very interested in your views and reactions. I think this will help us ultimately produce a better product in the end. One of the most basic propositions is that Russia can fruitfully be thought of as a particularly sophisticated hybrid regime. A hybrid regime being a political system that combines some real elements of democracy and some real elements of authoritarianism. A few people would actually call Russia a democracy, but it's interesting to observe Russia, I think, in comparative perspective especially, because Russia stands out for combining both a very high level of political control, the degree to which it's removed political uncertainty, especially from elections, but from a lot of politics in general, and combining that with a relatively low level of actual repression, violence, and coercion. You know, we're not talking, you know, labor camps, massive jailings of opposition figures. And I think in comparative perspective, this is rare. And in addition, it's also interesting that they have achieved this by a very, very elaborate system designed to ensure precisely that, which seems to be to try and avoid the most repressive actions that hybrid or authoritarian regimes around the world have been known to undertake, and still achieve this level of control. And so this kind of sophistication or elaborate nature of the regime is particularly interesting in comparative perspective, and we've been trying to think of other countries that might have similar levels of sophistication in this endeavor, and so we'd be interested in your ideas. I mean, one example that comes to my mind, it may be Singapore, but Singapore obviously is much less surprising because it's, it would seem to be on the face of it much easier to manipulate a political system in a island city-state. Whereas in Russia, we're talking certainly the biggest country in the world in terms of geography and one of the larger countries in terms of population, you know, very complicated in many, many ways. So I think it's quite remarkable that the rulers of Russia have managed to create this system today. Now, speaking in I guess, stylistic terms, we're approaching this. One question is, why has the system evolved in this way? And I think, again, kind of from a not a historical standpoint, but a conceptual standpoint, the most obvious reason, I think, is that the authorities do want control, right? They want to stay in power. They want to provide order. But I think a point that is often overlooked is that the authorities actually still want to preserve elements of democracy because they benefit from them. And I think they benefit from them not only by trying to retain international legitimacy of some sort or making sure that they gain access to international clubs that make democracy a criterion, elements of democracy, and this is one of the points that we make in the working paper, serve beneficial purposes. They're beneficial to the regime in many ways. Democracy, political competition is a great way for generating information, generating feedback on what policies are working, what policies aren't, how the population is reacting to the things that you are doing, how likely, for example, a political uprising is going to be. Elections and democratic institutions can help provide this kind of information. Democratic institutions can provide a very useful mechanism for channeling political discontent, keeping people from going out into the streets and protesting and instead channeling it in a useful direction through established rules and procedures. Democracy can provide a mechanism for reconciling conflicts of interest in society in a way that can be useful for anyone trying to stay in power, which usually requires achieving some level of, if not harmony, then at least reconciliation of different interests. And there are many other reasons here that we can elaborate on. But I think the larger point is that there is a significant extent to which the Russian regime, basically, they want to have their democratic cake and eat it too. They want to be democratic, but at the same time, they want to be sure that they always win. And, of course, that's a fundamental contradiction. But I think this is largely what leads them to develop this very elaborate system. I think it is striking that they have gone to the lengths that they have to avoid a full-fledged authoritarian crackdown, which I think, I mean, my own view, I don't know what my colleagues is, but I think they could easily do it if they had wanted to. But they have their reasons for not wanting to, at least in the short run. And so there are several interesting elements to this approach to try and basically gut democracy of the uncertainty, which is by many counts its essence. And one of these is to essentially find reasonable, what they would consider reasonable substitutions for democratic institutions. So where parliament is not fully functioning as a generator of ideas and a place where interests can be reconciled, where legislation can be produced, legislative initiative. There are a variety of other institutions that can at least provide some of these things in partial measure, but with much less political risk. So, for example, the public chamber is one of these institutions that we talk about, where it's not a formally elected institution, and it's basically created by invitation, but it starts to serve some of these functions related to legislative initiative, and it's become increasingly involved in the process of legislation. Of course, when you talk about political parties, there are still some of the real political parties left, like the communists, but then you have these virtual parties, as they've often been called, parties like A Just Russia, which are clearly, I mean, they talk the language of ideology or at least of opposition to some degree, but they're headed by people with very close association with the Kremlin. So, the degree to which they're actually autonomous is of course, quite dubious. And I think our general point, though, about substitutions is that we're in a sense arguing against the view that these are all virtual institutions in the sense that this is all just one big elaborate Potemkin village. But instead, they're there to play real purposes, to actually do some of the things that democratic institutions really do. But they're an attempt to try and do that while avoiding the political uncertainty and the risk to the rulers in terms of staying in power. So we're arguing that they're not facades, but they are meant to be substitutions for democratic institutions. the ways in which the regime exercises control are quite subtle, certainly in comparative perspective. In the interest of time, I won't elaborate them. Plus, if you're here for the previous talk we gave, we talked about more of them in there, elaborated in the working paper. We discussed there the idea of a non-participation pact being at the core of what the regime is doing. So the idea being that people, in exchange for not getting involved in the political process, are provided at least with an appearance of the regime actually trying to take care of their concerns and providing economic growth. Manipulation of the media market, again, is more subtle than is often recognized. If you go to Russia, you'll see there are actually quite a wide range of publications there that you can read that present a wide variety of different views. Even on television, one of the things we've been discussing is, you can find relatively objective news coverage on television, in particular the television channel REN-TV, which is available in most major urban markets, which would be precisely those markets that you would be concerned about. But very few people watch REN-TV. Very few people watch the news. The ratings are relatively low, certainly compared to the state-controlled channels. And I think that one of the reasons that we've been talking about, one of the ways that they manipulate this, and I think Masha can talk in much more detail about this, is by manipulating viewers in much the way that American media markets manipulate viewers. You get people to watch your channel through high-quality entertainment programming, and then that has a big effect on what news people watch. And they also take various important sort of insurance measures, such as having friendly firms buy up these apparently independent outlets, so that if things ever do get out of control, you have a mechanism in place to replace the management. But the bottom line is, they're going to some great lengths to make sure that to a certain extent, people don't feel a great lack of freedom. Opinion polls about the Putin era, I think, show that if you ask them about personal freedom, people don't feel, on the whole, that personal freedom has declined under the Putin era. And I think these are some of the reasons why. And the final element that I would just emphasize here, there are more, is that this is a system that has come to depend very heavily on what we've described as manual management. Control is very centralized. I think to some sense we could even describe the system as micromanaged democracy, because it depends on the rulers, in particular Putin and a very close set of associates, intervening personally on very minor technical issues in order to exercise this control. But at the same time, the system is built so that it's constantly recalibrating, it's constantly adjusting in response to new popular moods or new situations. So I think what, in general, if we're thinking about what Medvedev's arrival has meant, I would see it, and I think we see it together in this general light. The system itself really hasn't changed much at all. But what we have seen is just a new type of adjustment to the new situation that we've seen in Russia, a slightly new different, a new style of management, which serves certain purposes for the regime, and that this capacity to adjust based on the manual management of the people at the top is an essential part of the system and does not represent a change in the system. Now, I think the fact that the presidency itself has been handed over to Medvedev does create certain tensions within the system, but I think these are things that my colleagues will elaborate on. So I think that will serve by way of an introduction to the topics. So without further ado, I'll turn things over to Nikolai.
Okay. Thank you, Henry. I would not take Medvedev's midterm too seriously. I would rather speak about Putin's decade in power. But this year, I feel like this year is decisive. There was a system designed during Soviet times when each year or five-year plan was called somehow, and the third year was called decisive, which meant that, finally understood whether the five-year plan would be realized. So starting from the beginning of this year, we do have a lot of interesting events, and it's possible to speak that the political life in Russia is much more intensive now than it used to be. There was the State Council on Political Reform. There was the wave of social protests in very different regions. There was this harsh exchange between United Russia functionaries and Sergei Mironov, the Speaker of the Upper House, and then Kudrin, the Minister of Finances. There was in source paper on Russia, how we'd like to see it, and Surkov's interview in Vedomosti. There is ongoing scandal with Ministry of Interior, and finally the Kremlin replaced several governors' heavyweights, starting the process of generation change among regional leaders. So I would read all these events as a sign that there is growing understanding among political elites that the system should be changed and that the political modernization is needed in order to make the system sophisticated enough to face those challenges which are appearing now. So speaking about governors, I would say that what we see now, it's a very decisive moment. At the very last days of the last year, the final governor was replaced, who was staying in his office being elected, not appointed. So more than 100 governors were replaced during this five-year cycle. And not only it's interesting that the first cycle of replacement is over, it's interesting to look at how the share of carpet baggers of Varangian governors is growing, and it's really very big now. So up to 2/3 of all replacements which took place last year and a half were the cases when carpetbagger was coming to replace incumbent governor. And not only this, but strong guys have been replaced, and it looked like a kind of a punishment when first Yegor Stroyev, the former speaker of the upper house, was replaced, who supposedly could lead the governor's protest. It was in early 2009. Then Yevdokimov, governor of Murmansk, who got in public scandal with the local United Russia, was replaced. Now Shaimiev was replaced, and I would be amazed if Yuri Lushkov and Murtaza Rahimov, who are two last heavyweights who did protest against the Kremlin last year when the crisis was in its bad shape, they will stay in office. What is interesting about these replacements, it's not always seen, it's the fact that the Council of Federation, where majority of these guys are finding their last job, is becoming more interesting because, you know, instead of businessmen and instead of very strange, retired persons from the federal political elite, now more and more former governors and heavyweight governors are coming there. Regions, it was the matter of the Kremlin's concern, and perhaps Masha will speak more about how they are trying to keep the balance in media between Putin and Medvedev. What strikes me is the fact that each of them did visit 34 regions last year. And, I don't know how exactly it was calculated, but anyway, it's twice as much as usually Russian president, not to speak about the prime minister, is visiting. There are package firings, like Medvedev has started with firing four governors, then the turn of, militia generals came and so on. And it looks like head of bad boyars are presented to a population sometimes. And I would not overestimate Medvedev's decisiveness in comparison to Putin, but there is very interesting psychological effect, which is connected with the fact that Medvedev is not very happy with this gap between his formal and his real role. And he tries to be as cruel and as tough as possible in cases where it's allowed for him. That's why he can be very harsh in some discussions. And I look at this as a compensation for being humiliated by his senior brother. Where Putin and Medvedev do stand, I would say that this is not absolutely not important. And Putin, perhaps he likes modernization or he doesn't like modernization, but it's not a problem because he's not an absolute tsar, and he does show the balance between major elite clans. That's why if the understanding that, the system should be modernized in political sense will come to elites, Putin will do it. And I would say even more, to my mind, the sooner Putin will come back to the office, the better, the easier it is to wait for political modernization, because now he's not in a position to benefit from any kind of political changes. He did construct a very complicated system which possessed him to rule, staying not at the very center, at the formal center of the system. That's why any political changes can can be seen as damage for him. So United Russia, it's very interesting case. You know that it was humiliated many times in past, including in recent past. What is new, it's the plan to organize eight regional conferences in each of federal districts before the next elections instead of national congresses. And there are two explanations why they did accept this plan. The first is that Putin is starting his campaign, and it's better for him to avoid Medvedev in any role, because Medvedev should come to participate in federal Congress, but not in these regional Congresses. But second is different. It's like, say, bypassing of federal United Russia leadership, addressing over their heads. And I would say that there is a vision that United Russia, and Putin is openly showing this, is a chair to sit in and nothing else. It's not any kind of party of power. The dynamics of crisis looked very different in course of the year, and before the government decided that the crisis was over, or at least the worst phase of the crisis is over, it was much more eager to play by more sophisticated rules of the game, elections including. And now, since last summer, it became sure that the crisis is over, and nothing should be changed. So, to construct now the bridge between what we see now and what we did describe in our paper, I would make a few general points. First of all, the system is basically the same, and it's very interesting to look at how it did manage to keep itself due to the fact that there are no institutions. There are substitutions, and by definition, substitutions are connected to major decision maker, to the president. And the president office was the single strong institution. Now it's not the case. So how the system did manage to do this? There are different ways, including so-called tandem or design. It's very interesting. Look at presidential councils. What did they invent to let Putin keep his leverage? They did invent another level, within the Presidential Council. So it's called Presidium of the Presidential Council. So if the Presidential Council is led by the President, Presidium is led by the Prime Minister, which means that Putin is keeping all these working, substitutions, like, say, the Council on Local Self-Administration or the Council on Sport and Winter Olympics in Sochi. And Medvedev presides over this huge body, which is gathering once a year, while Putin is organizing meetings much more often. In cases when it was impossible to do this, like in case of Presidium of the State Council, which is chaired by the President, Putin did create clones. There is his own Commission on Regions, consisting of top governmental officials and some regional leaders. But unlike presidiums, where regional leaders are rotated each half a year, in this Putin's new commission, he himself is defining who exactly out of regional leaders should participate in the next meeting. And the latest development, you've heard Putin is now chairing the Commission on Innovations, and no more Medvedev has his monopoly. By the way, Medvedev's Commission on Modernization is his brainchild, and it's the single substitution or the single body which appeared and which is working pretty actively. If you'll be interested, I will describe it in details answering questions. So environment is very different, and that's the problem. The system is pretty the same. Environment challenges are different. The social contract is still in place, although more and more often we can see some signs telling that no more non-participation is preferable for population because they do not see anything in exchange. There are challenges connected with the fact that the system is facing now more and more problems at different levels, and it didn't manage to work out any systemic response. So there are cases when manual management is used, but it can work in case of one Pikhalyova, one Baikalsk, but if only these cases will become more numerous, it will be no more possible to drive in this way. And the most important problem is connected with the fact that the time now is running much faster. Decisions should be made faster. And this creates very serious problem because the way how Putin avoided having the mechanism of checks and balances was connected with time. He was not making decision for pretty long time, allowing each side to reach him, and there was a kind of quasi-checks and balances mechanism, how interests of different elite groups could be balanced. No more it works, and more often we can see that decision was made, it was announced, and after this announcement, the real competition is starting, leading to either revision of the decision or postponement of decision and so on. So I would say that there are almost no cases of final serious decisions made in recent political past, although there are numerous cases of bad decision making. So I would finish with saying that illusion that the crisis is almost over is pretty widespread in Russia at the federal level, first of all, although the problem is still there. I would say that the crisis was postponed, and that's a major problem, not the fact that the government spent this or that amount of money. It spent this money in order not to fix the problem, but to postpone the problem. And it can be easily seen in case of regions. You know, last year, regional budgets used to be in a pretty good shape. In some regions, they used to be even bigger than in 2008 due to the fact that the Kremlin was afraid of social unrest and they were eager to give more and more money to regions. It's no more the case. The money is over, or at least the money for regions is over. And unlike the last year when the crisis was felt most of all in most developed regions, those regions which didn't depend from the federal budget, they lost their incomes and they didn't get anything or almost didn't get anything in exchange. But those regions, majority of them, which were subsidized by the federal budget, felt not that bad. Now it's not the case. There are cuts off and their budgets are now in much worse shape. Not to speak about the fact that, how these budgets addressed the crisis. They did refuse from all spendings except for paying salaries and pensions, which means that they didn't invest, they didn't, pay for communal services, and it means that problems were accumulating. And what we saw last year in case of, technical catastrophes in Sayana-Shushenskaya GS, in Perm, in Ulyanovsk, and in some other cases, ministries were different. Particular reasons why it happened were different, but generally speaking, it demonstrated that the whole system of management didn't work effectively, and it means that reset is really deadly needed for the political system, for the managerial system, first of all, and I would say that there are more and more signs that it's understood by at least some of political elites in the country. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Jim. Thank you, everyone. Always a great pleasure to be here. My focus today is the media. And I will focus, just as Nikolai will focus more on the more recent developments than on how actually the media was taken under control. Of course, it was taken under control during Putin's term, and this control is quite refined. Very roughly, it may be described as consisting of two major elements, one being the federal news channels that are tightly controlled by the Kremlin. And outside of the federal TV channels, as Henry mentioned, there is, of course, free expression. And some media outlets have used this opportunity. And this includes print, web, radio, TV, RAN TV in particular that Henry mentioned. The second element of control, however, is that in the absence of political competition and of checks and balances, the existing degree of editorial independence has been incapable to undermine the political monopoly of the ruling elite. Now, the emergence of Medvedev called for an adjustment of the media controls, most obviously because national television coverage that was tuned to one dominant political figure had to accommodate two. Actually, this task proved to be a very easy one and was fairly smooth. Both figures feature very prominently on state channels. Medvedev invariably gets more time. Otherwise, the operation has been very smooth. It is noteworthy that controlled television is an invaluable political resource that is shared by both Putin and Medvedev. This resource is so critically important that for all his talk about freedom, non-freedom, freedom more important than non-freedom, rule of law is important, etc., Medvedev has never challenged the operation of federal channels. In fact, early in his term, he told a Russian weekly paper that, I quote, "In its quality and the means used, Russian television is among the best in the world, and it is not pro-government." Nikolai was talking about the change environment. I would say that the main feature about change environment as far as the media realm is concerned is an expansion of free expression. And one way to look at this change is as evidence of the system's flexibility and capacity for adjustment that Henry was talking about. The Kremlin's main concern remains to adjust to the changed environment and avoid unpleasant social developments, yet to do so in a way so as not to yield any of the decision-making power. Here's a quote to illustrate the expanded freedom of expression. I quote, We do everything upside down. Everywhere in the world, political parties shape political opinion in a pool of political cadre. And in our country, bureaucrats put together party slates, organize elections, and issue assessments of elections. I will never believe that the majority of the Russian electorate want to vote for just one party. People do not want a monopoly. Monopoly in democracy leads automatically to a monopoly in the economy, and if we keep the monopoly, we will never overcome corruption. 20 years ago in the Kremlin, it was said, enough for the one-party monopoly. Let us live up to this good tradition. End of quote. Now, who do you think is the author of this manifesto of freedom and democracy? It is Russia's veteran liberal democrat, Vladimir Zhirinovsky. Zhirinovsky has superb political intuition, and if he's talking about political pluralism, etc., he likely knows what he's doing. What is more interesting is the venue where this praise of contested elections took place. Zhirinovsky delivered this speech at a session of Gossoviet State Council that Nikolai mentioned. This is a body that includes all Russian governors. And to discuss political reform, party leaders were invited. The transcript of the meeting is posted on the official Kremlin website for everyone to see. So the Kremlin website now has become a venue, yet another outlet of criticism and free expression. Early last year, the Council on Civil Society and Human Rights also met with the president, and its members were fairly radical in their criticism of the authoritarian practices. The issue of rigged elections was also raised, and solid evidence was presented by a political expert who also happens to write venomous op-eds in opposition media. His evidence is currently posted on the official Kremlin website, as is the full transcript of the meeting. Just as Putin before him, Medvedev holds regular meetings with top editors of the Russian media. The meetings themselves are off the record, just as Putin's were. But unlike the meetings with his mentor or predecessor, with Medvedev, the meetings are more informal and friendly. According to some of the participants, the editors ask challenging questions, including those about the decline of democracy, especially whether Russia should probably return to gubernatorial elections instead of appointments. They also asked about lawyers Magnitsky, who represented an American investment banker and died in jail because of malicious mistreatment allegedly aimed at forcing him to calumniate his client. Other examples of broadened freedom of expression. For example, the report that Nikolai already mentioned by the Institute of Modern Development, a think tank associated with President Medvedev. Medvedev happens to be the chair of the board of trustees of this think tank. The report, which paints a picture of Russia's desired future, is strongly focused on political shift toward a freer, plural, more democratic political system. Also, the media outlets that have pursued independent editorial lines all along seem to have gotten bolder over the past year or so. I would especially single out the debate over modernization and the criticism of a technological or Soviet-style modernization as opposed to a more radical social and political modernization. This debate goes on the pages of Russian print media, also on the web, on the radio, it is an ongoing debate. Even the federal news channels that are still tightly controlled by the government have become a bit more lighthearted with regard to the top figures. Channel One has launched a couple shows for younger audiences, and in these shows, top policymakers are sometimes treated with a degree of irony. The New York Times, around the New Year time, wrote about a puppet show in which puppets of Putin and Medvedev, unheard of in the previous several years, appeared on the screen. Of course, this is but a speculative suggestion that the expanded media freedom is the Kremlin's response to the potential risks generated by the economic crisis in the dual center of power. But by way of supporting this speculation, consider the words of Gleb Pavlovsky, one of the Kremlin's best-informed insiders. This is a quote. "The most serious lack of success Putin had was in his work with minorities. I mean intellectuals, creative groups, innovators, and so on. He was interested in creating a majority, and to a considerable degree, he neglected these small spheres, neglected the dialogue with them. And this created a certain vacuum that began to be filled with radical conceptions and radical activists. That is it is the state that has been acknowledged, but society hasn't. And the unacknowledged society has become a problem." It may be argued that in broadening the space for free expression, the Kremlin had the same rationale that underlined Putin's original choice of Medvedev. The choice of Medvedev obviously made quite a number of requirements, but one of them likely was a desire to attract those minorities, those same minorities that had been antagonized by Putin's authoritarian policies and hard, somewhat hawkish bearing. In this framework, Medvedev's job may be generally seen as that of reaching out to or appeasing or softly co-opting those unacknowledged, to use the expression of Pavlovsky, but vocal minorities, which theoretically might emerge as a challenge to state authority. These activists and media professionals may not be gullible or naive, but Medvedev hardly means to re-educate them or turn them into loyalists. The regime is much too flexible for such straightforward pressure. Its goal is more modest. After letting off steam in a meeting with the head of state, they are less likely to join with, again, to use the expression of Pavlovsky, the radical conceptions and radical activists. It's not that there is imminent danger of political experts, media community, or human rights activists to join the ranks of Limonov and Gary Kasparov and topple the regime. Rather, the Kremlin is trying to foresee and preempt undesired political developments. So critics in the political establishment, expert community, etc., would not get too carried away by the talk about political reform, like in Gossoviet or the Medvedev's think tank. There are cautionary signals coming all the time from the decision-making level. At the end of the State Council session, Putin threw some cold water. According to rumors, he appeared at this meeting unexpectedly. His tone was harsh and peppered with his trademark colorful lingo. The political system, he said, should have a degree of sound conservative and shouldn't be shaking as a piece of jelly. He denied that the United Russia monopolized the political scene and dismissed any allegations of election rigging. He angrily waved off stories of election rigging posted on the web that were mentioned by one of the party leaders. 50% of the web, he said, is porn stuff. Why would anybody pay attention to it? Now, speaking of humiliation that Medvedev goes through, this remark is noteworthy because Medvedev not only has his own blog, but always emphasizes that he is a fan of the web. To those who may have been inspired by Medvedev's sharp criticism of the state affairs in Russia in his address to the parliament last year, the president had a warning in the end. Any attempt to use democratic slogans to destabilize the situation, the government, and to split society will be prevented. Harsh treatment of political rallies in Moscow, as well as a number of additional police measures recently enacted or under consideration today, suggest that the government is prepared to draw on harder ways to hedge against social discontent. The Kremlin powerful political aide, Vladislav Surkov, added his own cautionary signal. Nikolai mentioned his interview that he gave. It's a rare interview he gave to a liberal business daily, Vedomosti. He said that in 2011, United Russia will win because it is good for modernization. The system should be preserved, he said. It shouldn't be rejected. We shouldn't let in anything that can destroy it. Surkov's interview is a good example of how independent media are used not just to let off steam of the critically minded, but also as a kind of a bulletin board for the elite where they can exchange messages with each other. Surkov's interview outlined a vision of modernization led by the state that would remain an uncontested decision maker. Indeed, as Surkov said in the interview, unwelcome forces are not let in. Yabloko Party was barred from participation in local elections to be held next week in the same heavy-handed fashion that was previously used to ensure the monopoly of United Russia. Sometimes, however, the expanded freedom of expression has an appearance of a genuine fresh freedom. Consider the endless stream of publications about police violence in all kinds of media, including federal television. After a horrible incident a year ago when a drunk policeman opened fire in a Moscow supermarket, killing two and injuring seven, there has been a flurry of reports about rape, torture, and murder by policemen. Seemingly in response to these reports, President Medvedev announced a police reform. Its first steps were made public a short while ago. What makes this development, however, distinctly different from free press operation is the path from media reports to an executive decision. The latter is made in a non-transparent fashion and is not preceded or mediated by an institutionalized discussion. Of course, in the limited realm of independent media, discussion goes on all the time. In the case of the police reform, there can be no institutionalized discussion of the causes of this dramatic degradation of law enforcement or whether it might be in some way related to the political system, which rules out public accountability. Nor is there an institutionalized discussion of whether the measures suggested by the president would indeed help improve the performance of the police. A genuine political discussion of this sort might have unpredictable consequences for the incumbent power, and unpredictability or uncertainty, as Henry put it, is exactly the factor that Putin's Kremlin had securely eliminated during his presidency. So the Kremlin may use the independent media reports to send a message that the government is aware of problems and takes care of them, but the leadership still remains unaccountable, media operation notwithstanding. As a result, the stream of reports about police abuse looks more like a campaign, an example of hybrid regime finesse, than as an institutionalized free press operation, even if quite a few reporters take genuine effort to cover ugly practices of the police. So far, the Kremlin's elaborate practices have been effective, and the ruling elite remains essentially unchallenged. But in some cases, expressions of public anger has an impact and can even produce accountability. Just last week, two women were killed in a car crash in Moscow, which involved the chauffeured Mercedes car of the vice president of Lukoil. According to witnesses, the fatal accident was caused by the Mercedes driver. A high-ranking executive like this is sure to have good connections that should would enable him to escape responsibility. The oil company immediately announced that the chauffeur did nothing wrong, and there are reasons to believe that initially the police helped them hide some of the evidence. The blogosphere responded with an explosion of outrage. Russian Association of Automobile Drivers called for witnesses to show up, and four people indeed showed and volunteered to testify. The same association threatened to boycott Lukoil gas stations. A popular rap singer wrote an angry song about the accident, which immediately gained broad popularity on the web. A left-wing political group announced that it would stage a picket demanding a fair investigation of the accident. The story is not over, but already the police was forced to make public the images of the accident recorded by a street video camera. If the Lukoil executive is indeed to blame, he'll hardly get away with impunity. In a similar accident 5 years ago, the son of the then Minister of Defense, Sergei Ivanov, went unpunished after a fatal car accident in which he ran over an elderly woman. Of course, there's a long way from such an episode to a public demand for government accountability, but some effect of free expression is undeniable. And the web that Putin so easily dismissed as a porn outlet may play a bigger role in the future if more elections are rigged or as accumulating problems and policy failures generate discontent that the government will find increasingly hard to quash. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you all. I think now I'd like to turn to the audience and let you come up with what you would digest of this. So in the back, could you identify yourself and use the microphone?
Yes, hello. Dr. Katarzyna Pisarska. I'm the director of the European Academy of Diplomacy in Warsaw, Poland. I'm also a visiting scholar here at the Center for Transatlantic Studies at SAIS. I have two questions, one to Mr. Pietrow and one to Mrs. Lipman. You spoke about the financial crisis, and a lot of us believed at some point that because Russia was so much hit by the crisis, that it would in fact exige some kind of deep reforms of the country, and that there would be some kind of social unrest with the changing situation. You spoke about the government policies at the moment trying to kind of push this crisis forward, but what are the public opinions? What are the feelings? Has the crisis affected average citizen of Moscow or any other city in the country? And my question to Ms. Lipman concerns more civil society and the state. How would you assess the state of the non-governmental sector at the moment? But I'm mainly concerned about that unpopular among the government NGO sector that deals with democracy promotion, which deals with all those issues that are, of course, uncomfortable for the current Russian administration, because, of course, other NGOs across the country do get financial support from the government and have often a very good relationship with the government. So I'm interested mainly in those who have been in some way prosecuted. And to the both of you, how does the Carnegie Center deal with the new administration? Has the tension increased, lessened? What has changed in these 2 years for you? Thank you.
Kolya, do you want to begin?
Okay. I'll try to be brief. A year ago, there was huge discussion about this non-participation pact Henry mentioned. It was understandable that if the government no more was considered to be in a position to increase salaries, pensions, and to provide increasing life level and so on, then there were expectations that social unrest or at least political activism will increase essentially. It never happened this way, partly due to the fact that the government did its best in order to avoid this, and continued to spend huge money, which amidst the crisis was read as perhaps Putin's plan even to organize early elections, because you know that starting from January 1st this year, pensions has been increased very essentially, and it creates very serious burden for the budget. But I would say that although the social contract is still in place, there are more and more signs that it doesn't work that well. And we could see this a year ago in Vladivostok when there was massive social unrest caused by the governmental decision which didn't take into account regional interest. But starting from this January, we can see a growing wave of social unrest. In each particular case, it can be explained by different reasons, by environmental reasons in Irkutsk, by economic crisis and bad governance in Kaliningrad, by some communal problems in Arkhangelsk and so on. What is common in all these cases is, first of all, the fact that there are carpetbaggers governors, which means that against the background of growing instability, it's much easier for those guys to cause huge personal hatred and reaction and to cause this social unrest. And it puts the Kremlin into a very complicated position, either to replace these guys, showing its weakness and answering these social protests, or to keep them in power and to face additional problems connected with bad management. So I would say that if the last year was perhaps the last when this social contract was in place, and now we see that it's over. Speaking about our relationship with authorities, I would say that Medvedev is the guy who did visit Carnegie Moscow Center 10 years ago. At the time, he was campaigning for Putin. Since that time, all our attempts to attract anybody from this team failed. And in last presidential elections, we got Zhirinovsky, we got person number two from Communist Party, but none of those guys, including our personal acquaintance, appeared to present Medvedev's views. But that's all. So I would say that they aren't very focused on what we are doing, if especially to speak about our programs, and we are not taking care a lot about them.
Well, I think one reason why we do not see the big change in the public mindset that was probably expected in late 2008 is because oil is at around $80 per barrel, not 40, and the government still has the capacity to buy the compliance of the people, which it effectively does. As a result, even in spite of all those protests that are, I think, gaining steam right now, the overall numbers of the approval by the Russian people, as seen in the polls, remains very high, and what is even more more important, it's steady. It's around 80%, just under, well, 75 to 80, 82 for both men. Usually, always, Putin is slightly ahead, and Medvedev tracks him like they go in two parallel tracks. Talking about NGOs. Well, as you rightly mentioned, Medvedev, by the way, Medvedev, not Putin, differentiated between two categories of NGOs in Russia, those that are socially oriented, or as we probably should read it, those who do not mess up with politics, and others. The group of socially oriented recently also accommodated religious NGOs, which was a big concession to the church. The church also wanted financial support for its own non-government organizations. I would say the situation for more politically oriented, I'm not sure how to put it, maybe not socially oriented, but more politically oriented NGO has hardly changed. They could never expect the government to show benevolence. The environment has been not friendly for them, but not to a point. The regime, again, I would emphasize what Henry said, is sophisticated and subtle. It would not directly attack NGOs for very rare exceptions, and those exceptions usually happen locally when the authorities are more heavy-handed, less sophisticated than they were in Moscow. So I think it's basically the same way. I would say, put straightforwardly, is democracy promotion. I don't think such organizations can hope for to achieve much in Russia, but those that do very concrete things like civil litigations, like against torture, all sorts of, well, I will not go into the list. Soldiers, mothers, of course, is a very prominent example. And all the major ones remain in place. Helsinki Watch, Human Rights Watch, Memorial, all the big major veteran organizations that have been on the scene for about two decades are all there, all reliant on foreign financing, and all are doing good work, and I can't see how this would change. I'm not sure what you meant by saying an organization that was prosecuted. I think maybe there were very few cases in the provinces, but it never ended dramatically. So I don't think that the environment is that unfriendly for non-government organizations. And just one more word to add to what Nikolai said about the rallies, the protest rallies, that indeed are quite impressive and have been quite a lot. And for March 20, people in Kaliningrad, who so far were able to stage the biggest rally in Russia, the biggest in a decade, promised that they would bring 20,000, so we'll see. However, I would want to emphasize that this is not a movement, rather a mood. There are no clear political demands except for very emotional, like Putin should go out, but not a glimpse of who should go in and what they actually want, except for very limited local causes of socioeconomic nature.
Bob Kaiser of the Washington Post. I too have questions for both Nikolai and Masha. Nikolai, you talked about the polls that show that Russians feel that they're free, and I know this from personal experience too. It's hard to get anyone on the street to say, no, we're prisoners of this new regime. What's the danger that this sense of being free might actually become a temptation in some unforeseen circumstance to actually act free in a political context? I think there's an interesting psychological issue here. If indeed, and I think it's true, citizens say, you know, it's not what it was. It's a different kind of a country. We are free. We travel. We do this. that they might start to want to do things differently. What's the danger for the regime? And Masha, I'd love for you to speculate. I know you can only speculate on the decision-making process that led to the fact that you described of Medvedev always getting a little more time on the evening news than Putin. And how? And what's the danger that that confuses people? What's how do ordinary people understand that? How would they interpret it?
Koya?
I would start with saying that if it's possible to wait for serious troubles for the regime this year, these troubles will be caused by the regime itself rather than by political opposition or by mass protests, which will be not inspired by the regime making serious mistakes. And it leads me to elections. And this is, I think, very, very important point. In a week from now, we'll have elections in more than 70 regions. And in some cases, the way authorities are, behaving in elections is absolutely the same as they used to behave last October when causing huge scandals, at least, if not mass protests, connected with electoral fraud in Moscow City Duma elections and in some other cases. And I did publish today a piece on elections in Moscow Times, and let me tell you about one very demonstrative story which is going on in Irkutsk. Irkutsk is a large-scale Siberian town where we did already have many cases of mass protest movement connected to environmental issues, first of all. What they do have now, they did send there the governor, Kapit Beger, who originated from St. Petersburg. And when the guy came to town, his first move was to avoid any kind of political competition. And in order to do this, he sent the former mayor of Irkutsk as his representative to the Council of Federation. The position is vacant, and elections are going on. What they did decide, in order not to have strong governor, they did invite the guy from Bratsk, which is from the same region, but it's 1 hour and a half by plane, and it's well known for criminal business and for Deripaska's presence. So the guy from Bratsk is strongly connected with both. So he was appointed active mayor of Irkutsk, and it did already create very strong social protest, and it was this decision which consolidated opposition. So everybody is fighting now in Irkutsk against this Kapit Beger, who was appointed by another Kapit Beger, their present governor. And how did they react? They've seen sociological polls told that the guy has 10% popularity. So they did push out the more popular candidate on the ground that his signatures were invalid. They did discover this in 10 days before the voting. And that's an interesting case because, Medvedev all the time was saying that, elections are somehow going on. They are not perfect, but we should make them better. And that's why I would say the damage for Medvedev's reputation, if only elections in a week, will be held in a way they were held last fall, it would create very serious damage. Until now, there was damage for Medvedev's reputation here in the West or somewhere else, but not in eyes of ordinary citizens. And this is the clear example how the problem can be created without any real reasons, but due to the fact that, first, the Varangian governor was appointed, he had free hand to do whatever he wanted, and there wasn't any kind of mechanism, foolproof mechanism, to prevent him from doing these stupid things.
On the issue of how time and television is distributed, actually there was a fairly good description of it which was not merely speculative, in Russian Newsweek in the summer of 2008, how the how state television is accommodating two people instead of one. This is a sophisticated operation that is run jointly by top TV managers of the federal channels and some in the Kremlin administration. They used to meet weekly on Fridays. I was told that this is no longer the practice, but now they are on the phone all the time. But television managers are such savvy figures themselves that they can figure out what's the right thing to do. So I think because the real authority is with this is pure speculation. The real authority is with Medvedev. The real authority is with Putin. Medvedev is given the formal vestiges, and one of them being he should have more time on television. The best Russian mainstream daily, Kommersant, runs a daily gorging of time on air of both people, so you can tell that for very, very rare exceptions, Medvedev gets more time. However, in the polls, when people are asked who's got more authority, the most common answer is the authority is equally divided between the two, which is the message that is being sent, that they are friends and that they are a good tandem. About 50% believe that the authority is divided equally. However, those who think that it is not divided equally, three times more people think that the authority lies with Putin. And about 11 or 12% think that the authority lies with Medvedev. So they're not only based on the time on air and on the attention that Medvedev is given. And just one more remark about freedom, how people say they're free. One of Russia's best sociologists, Boris Dubin of Levada Center, wrote a piece not a long time ago trying to interpret how freedom is understood in this case. And it is not about we have the freedom to travel, to vote, to whatever. Rather, he describes as a paternalistic freedom, the freedom of responsibility. Non-participation pact, as we described it, the freedom not to bear the burden of citizenship, if you like, of sharing the burden of decision-making with the government. Actually, this is accepted and is accepted with relief.
Ariel, you. We wait for the mic.
Ariel Cohen, the Heritage Foundation. You're describing basically a slight rise in discontent. It's an emotional situation. It's an emotional condition. As somebody said, it's not a movement, it's a mood. If you extrapolate and look at the weak points in the system, where are those weak points? What can give? What can crack? And if it cracks, A, what kind of response the system will have? Will it show fangs or will it accommodate, incorporate those who may lead protests, Nikita Belych or whoever? And the second issue is you did not mention any alternative elites. Who are they? Are these people in the ersatz parties or are they somewhere else? I'm not talking about Kasparov and people like that, but are the people that are not in front that we're not talking about who may come to power, and if so, who are they? What kind of power they will exercise? Thank you.
Well, I suspect that full answer, would take another hour or so. So, starting with weak points, I would say that there are almost no strong points. And, we are dealing with all these weaknesses in this publication, and I would say that they are almost the same now as they used to be, except for one very important thing. You know, I am telling all the time that the tandem is very formal way to describe this regime in a sense that Medvedev doesn't play any important role at all. The problem is that even formally being the president of Russia, he creates certain troubles for the system. And I would say that the system would carry either tandem or the crisis, but it cannot carry both in more or less effective way. That's why I would say that this is too much, and that's why I think that, rather sooner than later, the old state of affairs will be restored. It doesn't mean necessarily that Putin will... I think that he'll come back to the office. What will be the response? Well, I'm not counting on any good guys coming to replace bad guys. I would say that, to my mind, Putin could be much better if being restricted in a harsher way. So I am speaking about restrictions. I am speaking about rules of the game. I am speaking about, the need to strengthen institutions rather than to replace, bad guys. So they are bad because they are allowed to be bad, and they will be much better if only we should restrict them in harsher way. There are no alternative elites at all. So political parties and, Henry did publish a book about why not parties in Russia. They aren't playing any real role, and especially the role of growing alternative political elites. So alternative political elites are there. So it's not about personal shifts and personal changes. It's more about institutional changes, which either can be brought by the system itself if it's capable to react onto new challenges and it's capable to make itself more sophisticated, or it can be done in harsher way but with the same persons.
I mean, I just briefly say, in terms of the weak points of the regime, I think the way these types of systems tend to break down comes from splits in the elites, most of all. And in this particular case, one of the most obvious times for when elite unity can break down are secession crises. So I think that has a lot to do with the caution that, it was a very complicated process, sort of handing off the presidency to Medvedev without trying to create the appearance that there was a succession crisis. But I think that was a very delicate moment. But at some point down the line, I think that's where a lot of the weakness happens. But I think the other point is that I think public opinion has played an important role helping to preserve elite unity in this regime, because right now, if anyone tried to break away from, say, the Putin regime and tried to mobilize public opinion against it, it would be very hard for them to do, because I think, the popularity of the system makes it very, very difficult for them to do it. And so I think over the long run, deteriorating public support for the regime can have a very real impact on the system, weakening it, providing incentives for different elites to start playing their own games in a much more direct way. And the points at which that's most likely to happen, I think, will be during elections. And so, and most likely nationwide elections when everybody's focused on it, and most likely when you have presidential elections. And I think, therefore, the preservation of elections and the possibility of at least some real opposition competing, gives public opinion this extra role to play in the regime, because it's at those points that it can be mobilized by competing elites. And so I think, we have to think seriously about what the sources of public support for are the regime, and what are the situations under which it might seriously change. So far the regime has not shown the willingness to run roughshod over public opinion. The crisis showed that just an economic collapse, just kind of a one-off thing, isn't going to completely undermine the support in the system. I think they have a lot of reserves of support built up. But it doesn't mean that can change. I think over time, economic performance, if it slows down, will start to erode. People will start thinking that, the novelty of economic growth at a certain point starts to wear off, and people start expecting more. There's a possibility of fatigue, just kind of Putin fatigue. I think we're seeing some of that now. I mean, I think that's a good part of what's behind some of these, individualistic protests. I guess I don't expect anything to happen soon, but at least in terms of where the system is likely to change, I think the pressure points are succession struggles, in particular elections, and it'll be brought to a head, if public opinion really starts to deteriorate, in which case there's less obvious support for the incumbents.
Okay. Marvin?
Marvin Kalb with the Shorenstein Center at Harvard. My question is not so much about Putin and Medvedev as their staffs. It is natural in a vibrant political system for staffs to become very loyal to the boss, to represent the boss's views, to discuss them. Now, is there any evidence at all that among the staffs there is the beginning of some kind of discussion that my boss has a better idea than yours, and discuss those things with reporters and deliberately seek to propagate difference?
Yeah, there's actually plenty of evidence of this sort. And, you described it very accurately. there are indeed tensions between the staffs, and there are especially notorious struggles going on, and people with knowledge who keep track of the developments can see the outward reflections of what is seen to be the conflicts, the tensions within. There are obvious jealousies among people who work for Medvedev, who work for the president of Russia, extremely powerful job, and yet are inferior either to those from Putin's administration who were left behind, either to help the new and inexperienced president or to exercise surveillance over him, and who are seen as senior to those people who are heavily emerged in the administration under Medvedev. And whenever there is an overlapping of authority, there emerge tensions. And this is even seen in the legislative process. It is seen how a bill made in the government, in the cabinet, and a bill made in the administration overlap and collide. And in a very graphic case just recently, there was a trade bill, an obvious conflict between manufacturers and retailers that the Duma voted for, and it was the president's bill, more or less. But then, in a very scandalous fashion, the Duma was forced to overturn its own decision in a dubious procedural way. Which just showed that the cabinet has more authority because Putin is there, and his priority in the conflict was different.
Okay. Andre?
Yeah, I'll come back to you in a second. I have a question to Henry. Henry, you mentioned at the very beginning that this regime could be called as a hybrid regime, and you compare it with Singapore, but you have said that it's not fully comparable due to size and due to some other features of both regimes. And we also can say that, qualitatively, level of civil liberties or political rights by those indicators, current Russia and Singapore are just world apart. What other hybrid regimes or any other regimes you would mention as similar to the current political regime in Russia?
Yeah, that's a good question. Part of the study is premised on the idea that Russia is kind of unique. It's kind of at the cutting edge of what one might call hybrid regime technology, in the sense of the degree of elaborateness of its apparatus for preserving its hybrid nature. But there's certainly other regimes that resemble it. A number of them in the former Soviet space. Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, Armenia, Azerbaijan. To some degree, Belarus are similar, but they're much less sophisticated in the way that they sort of balance the suppression or the balance the removal of uncertainty from the system with the relative lack of sort of harsh the most authoritarian methods. So in the post-Soviet cases, there are a number of regimes like that. To some degree, one could put, all these countries are different, but in terms of hybrid regimes that combine elements of democracy and autocracy, typically people point to countries like Tanzania, Venezuela, you know, Iran to some degree, you know, represents a kind of a hybrid system where control is you know, is still concentrated. You know, of course, they're the top authorities aren't actually elected in anything, but they still have some kind of competitive elections. So, you know, I think there are a number of cases worldwide that, you know, that are, I mean, you know, by most studies, the countries in the hybrid category represent about, you know, somewhere between 25% to 50% of countries worldwide. And so I think Russia is sort of out there on the forefront in terms of kind of inventing these hybrid technologies, which then, you know, sometimes get imitated by others or you know, or maybe it can only exist in Russia where you have the people that, you know, kind of have this particular skill involved and have the good fortune of being able to manage, you know, economic growth, you know, on the basis, of, at least to a significant degree, of natural resource wealth. So it's a broad category, hybrid regimes, and part of what we're doing here is to try and differentiate it and, you know, look at what makes Russia, you know, unique within this category, despite the fact that I think there are some similar cases out there.
David? Yeah. David Kramer, German Marshall Fund. Masha, I wanted to come back to Marvin Kalb's question about the tensions between the staffs and push you or, and maybe the others too. When we look at the presidential administration, there are a number of people held over from when Putin was president. So which people specifically are the ones inside, not the ones on the outside? We know who those are. But on the inside, who are the ones pushing for Medvedev? You look at Sobyanin, holdover, Surkovsky, holdover. So which people are the key top Medvedev people? Thanks.
Well, I think I will start. Maybe Nikolai will continue. Of course, the obvious person is Natalia Timakova, who works for Medvedev and who is regarded as one of those engaged in struggles and tensions, and especially with Surkov. And she, I think, is an ambitious and talented and creative woman, has seen herself humiliated by being bossed by Surkov. And I think, purely speculative on my part, that she would certainly want him out. And it may be speculated, again, purely speculative, that some of the publications aimed directly at Surkov in the Russian independent media may have, I don't know, been somehow coordinated with her or whatever, something that she certainly likes to see when it appears. I think it's also a limited view to see this just as tensions. Tensions are certainly there, but because there are, there is a dual center of power. This very naturally leads to the lobbying effort being directed at two centers, not just one. Whereas previously, the president's administration was the body where decisions were taken, so lobbyists would be geared there rather than elsewhere. Today, there is every reason to see both these venues as a target for lobbying effort, and we see evidence of that too.
Well, I would add that in most cases, these tensions are virtual. And you are right when saying that, Medvedev is surrounded by almost the same guys whom Putin left to him. So I would say that he's under house arrest, and he's not in a position to replace them. So it took a year for him to replace speechwriter, and that's all. So the system is well designed, and there are a few spheres where Medvedev can play a real role, and judiciary is one of them to a certain extent. And you can see that, well, there is the whole bunch of guys, Konovalov including, who are taking care of some reforms, like, say, penitentiary system reform and these new, amendments to make it easier for businessmen to not to stay in prison if doing minor violations of law and so on. But generally speaking, now, in 2 years after Medvedev took the office, we can use fingers of our two hands to name all those guys who are considered to be members of his team, but even these guys aren't, members of one and the same team. They came from the same class, from St. Petersburg University, that's all. So they are closely connected to Medvedev in person, but it doesn't mean that, well, they're doing something. And Commission on Modernization is another case where Medvedev is playing a certain role. It looks like the, well, minor government. And I was amazed, by the way, to see that in English there is no word for потешный. Потешный regiment was used when Peter the Great was a small boy, so he played soldiers like his toys, and it was a kind of managerial game. So I would use this word in case of Medvedev's Commission on Modernization. It's his brainchild. He does invest a lot of efforts. They are meeting on monthly basis. They're doing a lot, but they're very limited, and these limits were proclaimed by Medvedev in his Go Forward article. So it's allowed for them to invent something in order to make Russian pharmaceutical industry more competitive, but that's all. So it's about very limited number of spheres where technological modernization can take place. And in SOAR is another interesting example. You know, it's usually used as, it's usually percepted as Medvedev's think tank. It's absolutely not the case. So they do pretend to be Medvedev's think tank. That's all. So the way how they do communicate with him is just like being on unpopulated islands. So they're putting their reports into the bottle and waiting that sometime in future Medvedev will catch it and will read it. That's all. So my reading of this last in-source report is that they do no more hope on, playing certain role in decision-making, and instead of writing reports for Medvedev, they went public with much more radical things.
As someone who spent a fair amount of time studying Peter the Great, I'd only point out that some of those people in those regiments did pretty well. Anyway, Masha, you had
just one tiny remark. Of course, to those of you who remember Soviet political jokes, are disappointed today when jokes are fewer. However, there is one exactly to illustrate what Nikolai has just said, and it's very short. It says that Medvedev should win the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor.
All right, I'll take one more question, and then we'll have to break up. So take the eye.
Kathy Cosman, U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. Two quick questions. One is there indeed a new policy towards the North Caucasus? There have been a few rumors of that. And two, if you could speculate on the chances of passage of a new law on properties of religious institutions, which, in fact, I've been told, if it passes, would make the Russian Moscow Patriarchate the country's largest landowner.
Maybe you take the Caucasus.
Okay, I'll take the Caucasus. The easiest part of your question. So there are two regions which do attract Putin's attention most of all. It's the Far East and it's Northern Caucasus. And it's not, that strange that in both regions there are new plenipotentiary envoys, and both came from governor's offices, and they are considered to be good managers. So I would read Khlaponin's appointment to North Caucasus as a sign that no more the Kremlin can count on this military model of pacification, and they do try to do, and being very interested in this region due to the fact that Olympic Games is Putin's brainchild, and he does invest a lot of efforts, including managerial attempts, and he did use his best manager to deal with Olympics instead of dealing with less important problems like, say, center-regions relations. Anyway, the fact that Khlaponin was appointed there means that they do try to play by different rules of the game, but there are no hopes, to my mind, that it will be effective. I would say that Khlopunin can be seen as effective manager, but once again, he is carpet beggar, and never in his life he dealt with Caucasus and with national republics, which is very different thing from being successful manager in a big industrial plant and later in a region like Krasnoyarsky Krai. And second, the problem with Northern Caucasus, well, it didn't appear when Putin came to power. It was accumulating for pretty long time. It can explode any time in future, and I would doubt that something can be done in a short while in order to fix this problem.
On the church issue, the new patriarch is very active and politically, clearly, is very talented, and actually has prerequisites of becoming an independent political figure. According to one theory, which is set forth in a brilliant recent opinion piece in Vedomosti Daily, it's written that the Kremlin is apprehensive of potential rise, ascent of the Patriarch as a more independent political figure. Whether or not this is true, the Patriarch has been able to squeeze concessions, and they are material concessions, from the Kremlin in a very short period of time, one of them being as I mentioned earlier, church NGOs will be qualified as the socially oriented ones. In any case, will have special favors from the government. Another has to do with property. There has been a scandalous instance recently when a precious icon was actually shifted to a newly built church on the territory of the estate of a Russian billionaire, caused some scandal, caused huge scandal, but was shifted nevertheless. And there are permanent rumors that more precious pieces of art and actually buildings, monasteries, will become effectively the property of the church.
Okay, I want to thank all of you very much. And thank the audience for good questions, and we will gather again in another few months to see how we're doing. Thanks very much, everyone.